Silence! Jesus Christ, where did they get them? This will do for the history. Herbert Feigl teacher and good personal friend of mine who just died last year was a PhD in Vienna, one of the original members of the Vienna Circle, and other than his valuable contributions to the philosophy of science, scholarly literature, he has the propaganda function in that the first article in the English language dealing with the logical positivist movement was published in 31, by Feigl and a colleague named Alfred Blumberg. Blumberg subsequently lost his job during the McCarthy period for being a communist. Feigl had come to Harvard University on a Rockefeller fellowship from Vienna. And he and Blumberg got together and they published an article whose title was Logical Positivism. And that was the introduction of the term. That was not a term that the Vienna Circle used of itself. They didn't really call themselves anything at that time. But the movement therefore became known as Logical Positivism. And it was the view, as I explained the first day, that held up a meaning criterion, the verifiability criterion of meaning, had as its goal to liquidate metaphysics and to provide a rational reconstruction of science. Feigl, don't remember whether he went back to Vienna after his Harvard stay, but he was called to Iowa, to the philosophy department there, sometime in the early 30s, and then came to Minnesota in 1940. And that's when I first got to know him. I was a senior at that time. A little group of people, Feigl, a philosopher named Wilfred Sellers, now at Pittsburgh, a fellow named Hospers, who was the first presidential candidate of the Libertarian Party, Burnham Terrell, who was still around in the philosophy department, the late May Broadbeck, a positivist. She was dean of graduate school here for a while. This little group, I was the only non-philosopher in the club, I was the psychology member, began meeting shortly after World War II regularly at each other's homes, discussing epistemology and philosophy of science. And we founded a journal called Philosophical Studies, which Feigl, Sellers, and three of us edited for some years. It's still in existence, widely read, but it's not edited from Minnesota anymore. In 1953, Feigl, Sellers, and I cooked up the fantasy of having a center for the study of philosophy of science in which faculty permanently attached would be relatively freed up from various administrative or teaching duties, and which would have enough money wherever we could get it to bring in eminent philosophers of science and logicians as well as scientists of philosophical bent from all over the world. And so we founded this center, the Minnesota Center for the Philosophy of Science, in 1953. And we got a big grant from the Hill Foundation for 3 years, and they extended it for another three. And after that, we got it from Carnegie, and then we got it from the National Science Foundation, and I don't know where they're getting it currently. I was half-time on the center for the first 3 years of its existence, because the first 3 years we concentrated on philosophical problems of psychology, partly on methodological problems of psychological theory, but to some extent on the old traditional metaphysical problems like the mind-body problem and psychic determinism and stuff like that. That center became very well known over the world. It began putting out volumes, which are listed in your readings, the Minnesota Studies in the Philosophy of Science, and they're still coming out. I believe the last one was volume 11, and there are a couple more in press. And in addition to that, because we had so much dough, we were able to bring people like Feyerabend and Lakatos and Sir Karl Popper and the late Arthur Papp here for anywhere from a few days to a whole academic year for regular center discussions, which in the early days we tape recorded and which we never transcribed. That's one of the great delusions people had when tape recorders became easily available. You'd get all this, these gems down in tablets of clay. Well, we didn't, but we made a lot of progress in the problems. And in addition to the Minnesota Studies, the hardcover volume series, so it's not quite a periodical, it comes out irregularly, if that's the kind of thing it is. In addition to that, a very large number of papers were published by center members as well as by some of our visitors. So you find a lot of things in the philosophy of science literature with a footnote saying, I'm indebted to the Carnegie Corporation and the Minnesota Study, blah, 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 like that. Subsequently, we were such a roaring success that we were widely imitated. I think the first center after Minnesota's was at Indiana, and then there was one set up at Delaware, and one at Boston, and one at Pittsburgh, and there are several in Europe. So we had an impact in that indirect way. The our research assistant in the early days was Grover Maxwell, who was not a philosopher by union card like me. He was from another field. He was a PhD in chemistry. He had functioned as a chemist. He didn't become a philosopher because he flunked his chemistry prelims. He had functioned both as an academic chemist and subsequently as an industrial chemist. But he became very much interested in philosophy of science, came back to school, took courses, originally intended to get a second PhD, but if you have a PhD in a science, you automatically get prestige with philosophers of science. So he decided the hell with that. He didn't want to learn that much about Plato and St. Thomas Aquinas. So he never got a second academic degree. Maxwell ran the center until his untimely death, and some other people were then plugged in that were not didn't do all that much, so I won't go into them. But they were all right, but I mean, they were administrative holders, you could say. We were fortunate enough a year ago to hire Ronald Geary, who is now the director, who is a distinguished younger generation philosopher of science, and his book that just came out last year is one that I ask you to add to your reading list, Explaining Science, A Cognitive Approach. He's still in the process of doing psychotherapy on me, and in the sense of curing me of the residues of my old logical positivism and making me into somebody more comfortable with the what used to be called the sin of psychologism among philosophers. Whether I'm making any dent in him, I don't know yet. Anyway, he's an excellent man, very smart, good administrator, and I think the center is likely to revive. The years of the Philosophy of Science Center were extremely exciting. They were just thrilling. They were terrific, and to be able to talk with these characters like Carnap and Hempel and Popper and so forth was a real thrill. Geary has a PhD in philosophy, but he has a master's in physics, and he has done physics, done nuclear physics, and he took a sabbatical the year before he came here and spent his entire year working with physicists in one of the big nuclear physics labs. So he knows what it's really like, not from the armchair, but from being in the laboratory with working physicists. Well, I think that'll do us on the, as far as the straight history kind of stuff goes. I have a little conflict about what to do next. Because of some other things I had to do today, I haven't been able to do my homework for today's class, and I still haven't made up my mind, so I might as well flip a coin. I guess I'll go back to my notes, and if that doesn't work, I'll take the other tack. I want to get into the specifically theory testing in psychology and the problem of significance testing, but I can't do that without saying a little bit more of a general nature, because I will be wanting to use terms that some of you will know and some of you won't. I said before what meta theory is and why I preferred that term to philosophy of science, in that it emphasizes that it's the theory of theory and therefore takes account of the empirical component of philosophy of science, which the positivists tended not to do as much as they should have. We have to make a distinction between prescriptive and descriptive discourse. I assume you all know roughly what that is, but the point about descriptive discourse is that the verb involved is or was. It's indicative. It describes states of affairs, whether factual or formal, whereas prescriptive discourse contains crucial operative words are ought, must, and should. Descriptive discourse simply asserts regularities. Prescriptive discourse imposes rules. So it's the difference between the is and the ought, between what is and what should be, between, as Hegel would say, the actual and the ideal, between fact and norm, so that I can describe the moves of a chess game, but I can also say that Jones made an illegal move at a certain point, switched his bishop off onto the white diagonals. The reason the chessboards are white and black, you know, they didn't used to be in the Middle Ages. But people used to, when they were in a hot spot, shift off on the other diagonal, and so they started doing that. That's the bishop that stays on the black. So we ordinarily think of empirical science as being descriptive discourse, whereas jurisprudence, law, ethics, and, depending on your view of it, aesthetics, as being prescriptive discourse. Meta-theory, philosophy of science, is a mixture. That's where the old positivists went wrong, in that they really didn't realize the extent to which it was a mixture or had to be a mixture to do its job right. They thought they could do it almost solely with prescriptive discourse. And that meant that they didn't spend much time studying the empirical history of science, as I mentioned before. The main difference between philosophers of science and historians of science is that, officially, historians of science claim that they never engage in prescriptive discourse. You can catch them at it, but by and large, they are pretty faithful to that aim. That is, they tell it how it was, when Jones formulated the theory, why he didn't publish it for the first 6 years, why he was hostile against the other fellow's theory to such an extent, what was the effect of the economy or the French Revolution or the changes in the church or whatever on his theorizing, so that they are engaging in psychological and sociological and even economic explanation of the development of a science. Now, that kind of discourse that deals with how a science or a theory within a science changed and grew as related to psychological and social and political things is often referred to as the external history of a science. Whereas if you concentrate on the relationships of the concepts within scientific discourse, focusing on whether a certain fact was exaggerated or whether a certain theoretical move couldn't be made because of a constraint of some other general principle that everybody subscribed to, that kind of thing is referred to as the internal history of a science. Traditionally, one thinks of the internal history as being the domain of the rational and the external history of being either the irrational or at least the non-rational. Now, that distinction between internal, external, between descriptive, prescriptive discourse is related to a distinction between two contexts of inquiry formulated by Reichenbach in his 1938 book, the context of discovery and the context of justification. What he has to say about that is still worth reading, even though he thought he could make it cleaner than it is. When we are in the context of discovery, we are asking psychological and social questions about the discoverer. And the answers to those questions are psychological and social in character. The enterprise defines what would be an acceptable answer. The classic case in all the books is Kekulé and the benzene ring. I suppose those of you who took chemistry at least know about that one. He dreamed of a hoop snake and he woke up and he said, sure, that's the way the benzene ring works. I mean, you have these, how many are there, six of them, carbons. And then you have this business and then you have the hydrogen sticking out here. People have been trying to do it in some other linear fashion or in a three space. The benzene ring, as I understand it, is really literally flat in one plane. Six carbons hooked together, sharing electrons, and then the hydrogen sticking out. And he woke up and said, aha. Now that's a paradigm case of something in the context of discovery, isn't it? If two chemists got into a dispute about the merits of that theory, neither one of them would think of mentioning hoop snakes. And if he did, he would be criticized, right? The position would be, that's very interesting if you're a psychologist or if you're a historian of science, that Kekulé had that dream. But we are discussing the merits of the theory, and we don't care why Kekulé came to it or what psychic process produced this. That it was a dream is kind of a cute story. It's irrelevant to the truth of the theory. If Kekulé had come to it in some other way, by doing some fancy mathematics on the possible permutations and combinations of carbon and hydrogen, if he'd had a computer in those days and had spit this out as the only possible solution, that would lead us to be in the same boat we are now. The fact that he did it via a dream of a snake is totally irrelevant in the context of justification. Now, you have to start by understanding why Reichenbach would make that distinction. And I am irritated when some of the younger generation, not so much of philosophers as sociologists, want to completely wash it out, liquidate it entirely. I think that's a mistake. I think it's going to be obfuscating and counterproductive if we liquidate the distinction entirely. It's like many other distinctions you have to make. You start out by making them and then you qualify and amend. But you have to see the point of the distinction initially. And as a matter of fact, there's a name for a fallacy of mixing it up, isn't there? If you've taken beginning logic, it's called sometimes the genetic fallacy, sometimes the ad hominem. If I say to you in the course of an argument about economics, the trouble with you is your old man was a Marxist, that's an ad hominem argument. Or putting it the other way around, my Trotskyist friend Dave Cooper, when I was an undergraduate, if I'd make a certain argument, he would say, "Neil, a worker would never say that." You know, and I'd say, "Well, I'm not a proletarian. Look at my dainty little hands here, you know." Who cares whether a worker would say it? In psychology, the worst offenders in this respect are, of course, the psychoanalysts, who, when they are really in an epistemological squeeze, are likely to tell you the reason that you don't accept Freud's doctrines is that you haven't had an analysis. That doesn't work with me since I've had one and done it, but in that case, the gambit moves to, well, your analysis wasn't complete. By New York Analytic Society, mine would be very incomplete because it was only 385 hours. I mean, they just scratched the surface, you know. What a bunch. Anyway, we'll get back to psychoanalysis later in the course, and where I'll tell you what I think is good about it. So we start by seeing why Reichenbach would make this distinction. There are two different sorts of questions, prima facie. What's the psychology of Jones inventing this theory, and what's the state of this theory vis-a-vis the evidence, whatever led Jones to cook it up? And we start with that distinction, and that's an important distinction. I repeat, I think it's obscurantism to say there is no such distinction being made. One reason that people say that, other than have some grinding some political axe, one reason people say that is because they believe that if there are gray regions, then a distinction doesn't exist. I hope none of you is given to that particular mistake, but Edmund Burke said it right. The existence of twilight does not prevent midnight and noon from being tolerably distinct. Okay? And the difference between somebody who is bearded and somebody who is clean-shaven is a clear difference. Now, the fact that he might go out on a drunk for 4 days or decide to grow a beard and we'd see him after the first week and he'd look tacky, that doesn't mean that the statement, "Neil is bearded and this student is clean-shaven," is a meaningless remark, okay? And all sorts of things are like that. You can have an argument about brain death, but there is a difference between a 5-day corpse and the people in this room. So that slippery slope business is a very dangerous type of argument, very dangerous. It's also used constantly in constitutional law. They're always saying, oh, if you let them do this, then they'll have to do that, and there'll be in no end of it. The camel in the tent argument. Remember John Marshall? McCulloch against Maryland, the power to tax is the power to destroy, and Oliver Wendell Holmes said, not while this court sits, which is the right answer, of course. That is, there's a protection built into the machinery. So we don't have to say, since there's a distinction between the two domains, the two contexts of discovery, which is psychological and sociological, and justification, which is logic and statistics and scanning the data, we are not committed then to say that means there couldn't be any intermediate region here. There couldn't be any contexts in which you wouldn't be quite sure what sort of question you were putting. I don't think that Reichenbach would have disputed that. He doesn't discuss it in the book, but he was a smart man, and I assume he would understand that there's a gray region. Well, what are the main places where you have a mixture of considerations? Taking the context of justification, where we're supposedly asking what's the evidence and not asking psychological questions about the parties to a dispute, we do have cases where, in that context, we have to pay some attention to the psychology of the theorist or the experimenter. One is the matter of a finding that we are hesitant whether we should allow it into the corpus of belief, an alleged protocol, like the Dayton C. Miller ether drift. It is not fallacious in such cases when I am not about to replicate the experiment in my own lab, and we can't all replicate all the experiments, can we? If I'm not about to do that, and in the meantime, waiting for some other investigators to attempt it, I have to make up my mind how I treat this protocol. Especially if I'm a clinician, if I'm a practitioner, I can't keep things on the shelf, right? I have to decide. I have to act. Not doing anything is a form of action in the clinic. Well, in that case, if I know something special about the psychology of the investigator, it is not irrational to attach weight to the protocol as a function of that information. The extreme case is I know an investigator whose stuff never replicates. I mean, there are people who are famous for publishing brilliant articles and nobody else can get the same answers. Whereas in the Dayton C. Miller case, the problem was that here he was president of the American Physical Society and distinguished primarily as a careful experimenter. All of us who were involved in the controversy about latent learning, which started in the 20s, but it really got rolling in the middle 30s, and it was still going by the middle 50s. There was a 20-year period in which many psychologists were running rats in mazes and later in Skinner boxes. It's hard to get the phenomenon in the Skinner box, but my colleague Gail Peterson has got it there and is satisfied that it's true. In any case, people were running rats, and it was obvious that there was a correlation between whether you got latent learning and what lab you were in. And there was nobody disputed that. It was very distressing to people. It was what purported to be the same experiment, so far as the description of the T maze or the multiple maze or Blodgett's maze in Iowa, as in Berkeley. In Berkeley, they would get latent learning, and in Iowa, the Spence-Hullians would fail to get it. And here at Minnesota, McCorkadale and I would get it part of the time and part not. Yeah. That was a fun time. That was really fun. People were very excited about it. Well, when people were talking among themselves, not to the enemy, we didn't have any enemies because McCorkadale and I had a mixed leaning. I was somewhat of a Tolmanite at heart, and he was becoming more and more Skinnerian, and we got along just fine. But we were not grinding an axe, whereas the people at Iowa were trying to kill latent learning, and the Tolmanites and Leeper at Oregon were doing their best to bolster it up. So we, of course, thought that we were more objective than the Iowans and the Berkeleyans. But one knew that people discussed what was going on in the other lab and why somebody got these goofy results. And you didn't have to be malignant, the furor academicus it's been called, or odium theoreticum, to say that, well, people do differ in how they handle the rats. For instance, McCorkadale and I always thought, having visited Iowa and talked to Spence and his crew, that they were not very clinical about rats, whereas Tolman was explicitly clinical. Tolman, in published papers, said, now, when I'm trying to think about my theory of cognitive learning, I often, watching the rats sit there, and I think to myself, now, if I were him, what would I be thinking? Spence would not do such a thing. Or if he did, he would not tell anybody about it. The difference in the attitude, Tolman was kind of a sweet, benign, easygoing fella who never got very excited, including about his own theory, which meant that it didn't sell as well. And I hope you're all big enough and old enough and experienced enough to know that in science, as in other fields, it helps to sell. Feyerabend has written at length. He said, if you've got anything deviant, You've got to be a big mouthed. Otherwise, people won't pay attention to you, especially if your name isn't known yet. And Coleman was very easygoing. He didn't mind if some of his stuff didn't pan out. And he said that he wasn't going to try to work out equations the way Hull was because he didn't think the field was ready for that yet. And he wasn't that competitive with his brother. His brother, Richard Tolman, was a world-renowned theoretical and experimental physicist, expert in thermodynamics. Whereas when you talk to Kenneth Spence, who was not a bad man, I don't mean to say he was a wicked man, but he was pretty much committed to the Hullian thing, I'm telling you. And he believed that people who didn't see the light about that subject were sort of muddle-headed and benighted. And he was given to committing that sin I mentioned the first day, and that is beating up the opposition with philosophy of science. Tolman didn't tend to do that, although he knew philosophy of science and he'd published on it. But he did not use philosophy of science as a club in polemics, whereas the Hullians did. The Iowa Hullians were really quite, in my opinion, sinful in this respect. And there are subtle things that don't show up in the report. It doesn't mean anybody's dishonest. You don't have to be a faking data to not think that something is obvious when it isn't, not to put it in. We thought, for example, that we got good results in certain designs that were replications of Blodgett and when Iowans didn't, and that McCorkadale and I were very compulsive clinicians about test breaking the rats. Rats are not they're not the domesticated animals, you know, even less so than the cat, and who's less so than the dog. And so rats become anxious, and it's hard to say whether being picked up by a human is an aversive or an appetitive event for a rat if it's taking him back to his home cage, which is where he'd rather be than in this damn apparatus. And McCorkadale and I were very, very compulsive about petting them and test breaking for not just 2 days, but 10 days before the beginning of the experiment, and then having them in the experimental room running around in a maze-like thing before really starting the experiment. And our rats were benign, laid-back rats, and we thought that one reason we got good results was that we had placid, contented rats. That we were good rat clinicians. And that's what Tolman thought, too. For example, experiments using forcing are usually very bad for latent learning. I don't know what the recent statistics are, but when McCorkadale and I reviewed this literature in the Dartmouth Learning Book in 1955, it was quite clear that all experiments involving forcing, that is, a rat is, say he's got an alternation habit, and you put a door down so he has to go to the left repeatedly when he, quote, wants to go to the right, and they don't care for that. And forcing rats, especially under high hunger drive, tends to produce, as N.R.F. Meyer in his frustration book called it, rigidity of the behavior. And it was an Iowan who first showed that you can cure that by tender, loving care. You get a rat that has a very rigid position habit set up from forcing designs and being on an intermittent schedule under high drive. And that was Farber that did that, clinician. And showed that all you have to do is carry the rat over and set him down gently and let him eat a little bran mash at the choice point for about 30 seconds. And the next day when you run him, he will be much less rigid. Well, that kind of stuff doesn't get into the article, see. Parts of it do. I mean, you can specify how many days your test broke, or even how you carry him. Animals don't like to be carried as if they were going to be dropped, you know. And one should carry a rat on the arm. And McCorkadale and I decided, we didn't have any good evidence, that he should carry the rats because due to my cyclothymic genes, if I was having a manic night, why, I would move faster than normal. And McCorkadale, on the other hand, had a tendency to mix up the words left and right. And when you're doing T-maze research, that can ruin your experiment. I'm serious. So we decided, meal records, McCorkadale carries. You're not going to put that in the Journal of Comparative, you know. But there it is. So it has its humorous aspects, but the point is it does have some actual spillage into the stuff that gets out. Now, psychology may be in a lot worse shape than some other sciences in that respect, but if you read the book, I'm kind of blocking on her name, on the Nobel laureates and what they had to say about their research, or the big book on the moonshot, or various other books. Well, of course, James D. Watson's The Double Helix was practically scandalous to people, how much he revealed about the stuff that goes on and that affects the progress of the Enterprise. There they were trying to get data out of old Rosalind, what's her name, who should have shared the prize probably, and this other guy that did get it without saying too much. And meanwhile, they were pumping Linus Pauling's son to find out what Linus was up to and how close he was to the double helix and so forth. Well, some of that is pure context of discovery and interesting to the sociologist mainly. But the point is that it does impinge on your confidence level, especially when you cannot be at the lab and watch what's happening yourself. And obviously you can't be at very many different labs and watch what's happening yourself. Making an error in reasoning is frowned upon, but one can be forgiven. And making an error in your mathematics can be corrected. Somebody comes along and sees that there's a slip here in the formalism. But one of the unpardonable scientific sins, as I think I mentioned before, is faking the data. And what makes that such a gross sin? Is not only that it has a greater moral flavor to it than making a blooper, a mistake, an honest mistake, but the fact that it's not easily corrigible. Faking data means there's a datum on the shelf, like Dayton Miller's thing with the ether drift. And there it sits, and all you can do is wait for enough people to fail to replicate it, that you decide that I can't explain this occult effect, but I'm not going to include it in the corpus anymore. And therefore, I'm not going to require my theory to handle it. So those subtle aspects and sometimes not so subtle aspects of somebody's psychology, the extent to which he's passionate about the theory, the extent to which he's got a vendetta going against Dr. Glatz, all sorts of mechanisms of defense, reaction formations and projections and so forth, to the extent that those things can influence what happens in the lab in a way that you reading the published report cannot always discern, makes some amount of sociology and psychology relevant even when you're in the context of justification rather than in the context of discovery. Now, don't ask me how much. You've got to be very careful with that. Isn't it true? You can't afford to be saying, oh, I don't believe anything that comes out of Ising's lab. The hell with that. Clever Hans does all sorts of things, but I don't believe him. And there are people who take a very high-handed attitude towards other laboratories because they don't like the theoretical stance rather than because they have any track record on that lab to indicate that it tends to give non-reproducible results. Another place where you have to take account of the psychology of the scholar and that you are not being irrational in doing it is in reading a review of the literature. Why, if one subscribes to the bulletin, it's in large part because you want on certain areas to have a rough idea of what's going on in the world and don't have time, given your own specialization, to read 200 papers on Stanley Schachter's theory of emotion or whatever it is. Now, anybody who has gone back to read the original papers that a reviewer cites knows that you sometimes get, not usually, but sometimes, a pretty different picture of Fisbie's experiment when you read it than you got from the way the reviewer treated it. And again, this does not imply that the reviewer is an intellectual crook. He may be a little sloppy, or he may be influenced by his biases so that even working hard to be scholarly and objective, he didn't give a good report. Or the original paper was badly written, so it takes more work than the reviewer feels he wants to put in on that one paper, and you've got more time on your hands. You're not going to read 200 of them. One of the reasons for advocating the meta-analysis technique of literature review is that it presumably corrects to some degree for these factors, in that you expect some counterbalancing to take place in the meta-analytic mathematics that is hard to do subjectively in your head. Now, I don't know about you. It may be my senility, but when I read one of those bulletin reviews on a controversial subject, after I get done reading it, I frequently don't know what to say. And that is helped, at least, by a meta-analysis. Now, I'm not a fanatic about meta-analysis, but I don't like to hear psychologists who were not raised with it, I wasn't either, just brush it off on the grounds that they prefer to go into the intricate qualitative niceties of each of the studies. The human mind has one hell of a time processing that mass of information of 200 studies. And if you believe that you in your head can somehow optimize the beta weights for this versus that defect of a study, you are kidding yourself. See Meal, 1954. That is, the scholar is no more adequate at assigning optimal beta weights than is the clinician in optimal beta weights. So I think it's foolish for us to dismiss meta-analysis. But meta-analysis, like any other statistical technique, can be used stupidly, blindly, crudely, and as if it were a truth litmus test, a truth grinding machine. And you shouldn't use any method, factor analysis or taxometrics or anything else, like a moron. But all I'm saying is, one of the aims of meta-analysis is to enable you to discern relationships between certain characteristics of the experiments and the direction of the outcomes that are rather hard to filter through your cortex in an impressionistic way. You get some real surprises. It is no longer possible for people to say that psychotherapy is not efficacious. The meta-analysis of Smith, Glass, and Miller makes it quite clear that psychotherapy is efficacious. Just taking it as a generic process, not even talking about what kinds. It's also quite clear that some of the big factors that we thought were big, I mean, do not have as much of an influence in the outcome of the studies as we had previously supposed. And I don't notice that anybody ever was able to discern that before Smith, Glass, and Miller did a meta-analysis in their book. Well, we'll have more to say about meta-analysis later. I push it more than the people in this course differ in that respect. Licken is more suspicious of it. I'm more favorable to it. And Will Grove, if he comes in, is probably even more favorable to it than I am. Yes?
Are you going to go into meta-analysis and how it's done?
I hadn't planned to do that, but if I get enough people who want me to do it, why, I can probably stick it in somewhere. It depends on how far along we get. The two main books are Gene V. Glass and Company. I can't remember the other two, or are there three other authors. You can't miss it. The title, the meta-analysis is in the title. And the other book is Alzheimer's. Does anybody know Hunter and Somebody? I can't do it. Hunter and Somebody have an excellent book on meta-analysis. It's available in paper-bound. I think Glass is only hardcover. I look upon it as an extremely important methodological contribution. I rank it up with things like factor analysis, but I should tell you that a lot of my colleagues do not feel that way. Professor Telligan is really quite unsympathetic to it. Um, Let's see, is there any other place in the context of justification where we want to talk about the psychology of the person? Raw data aspects, reviewing. Oh, yes, here's a very big one. This is terrible. This is not so much psychology as sociology, the external history, and that is Big Brother. When you survey the research in a field, in addition to the question how much of the research never got published because the editor was biased against null results or because the author left it in his drawer, how much that goes on is still in controversy. Rosenthal doesn't think it's so big. Other people deny that. I'm not an expert on the latest state of that one. I know that I have left some things unpublished in my drawer because they had negative results, and everybody around here that I've asked admits that that has happened. So I assume that it must take place with some frequency. We know that editors are more reluctant to take null hypothesis findings than significant ones, and that's partly rational and right out of Fisher, isn't it? Because if the power function is low, then a null result doesn't tell you as much as a significant one does, given the same statistical power. So I take it for granted that there is some of that in-the-drawer stuff that's lost to the research literature, but I do not have any basis for saying just how big it is. But there's a factor in addition to that, and that's what kinds of research is done because it's popular or faddish or gets well-funded. I don't know how much you know about the way universities are financed these days. The University of Minnesota charges Uncle Sam 42% indirect costs on a research grant. The professor gets $1 million research grant. That's a big chunk of additional money that comes to the school. It is, of course, to anybody knowledgeable, a ripoff, because if you ask yourself, what are these indirect costs exactly? It's not the professor's time. A, he's supposed to be doing research anyway, and if he doesn't, he won't get tenure. If he takes himself off some teaching, that time is paid to some cross-charge individual on the grant. If he needs secretarial help, that's paid for on the grant. His apparatus is paid for on the grant. They wouldn't turn off the heat if this room were not being used. They would turn off the light. I guess it comes down to electrons to keep the lights going is the only real indirect cost. The idea that it's 42% is totally out to lunch. It's just it's an absurdity economically. Private foundations won't hold still for that. They will say maybe, what is the one that Garmazy helps run, MacArthur? They'll hold still for, I think, 15%. What happens then? The university takes 15. You call up Mr. Potami, who's a very nice man for a bureaucrat. He's very effective, unlike most bureaucrats, too. And he really helps the researcher. He's a great guy. You call up Potami and say, well, how small a cut will you put up with? And he'll tell you with some reluctance that, well, if it comes to it, nothing. So if you get the FISBE Foundation, that's a little penny-ante outfit, and it won't hold still for any loading charge, they'll take it. So why does Big Brother hold still for 42? Because Big Brother has the power to tax you, that's why. So he doesn't give a damn how big the cross charge is. That's why, that's the only reason why. Harvard charges Bethesda 70% loading charge on research. Stanford charges 70%. Well, what has all this got to do with the advancement of knowledge? Well, it has a profound effect upon it. The university gets in the habit of having this big chunk which it can put in the big central pot and use for what it pleases. I mean, it's not assigned to Elliot Hall cleaning the floors when they get that rake off of the 42%. It goes into the big central pot where the libido flows out of. And so some of us are advocating that to motivate and use incentive, like in private industry, that a certain fixed amount of that should come back to the department which commanded all of those funds. You know what percent of the arts college outside funding is paid for by the psych department? How many are there 35 departments in the liberal arts college all told? All the outside funding, 52% comes from Elliott Hall. But we don't get any additional benefit in terms of clerical support, more secretaries, more higher salaries for the professors and so on than Portuguese poetry does. Not that I'm against Portuguese poetry, now. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying good economics would say that you ought to do something about seeing to it that it comes back to the people that are bringing it in. In any case, I'm not complaining. I got a big fat salary, more than I deserve, but some of the younger people have cause to complain. What happens? The university is accustomed to this now. They've been doing it for years. Since they're accustomed to it, it's an essential part of running the joint. If those grants suddenly dried up, the place would be broke. I mean, we couldn't raise the taxes in the legislature. We'd have to fire tenured professors, literally. So what happens as a result of that? Departments tell assistant professors, you know, you're bucking for tenure. You want to get to be an associate professor, you've got to get some grants. In the medical school, they tell them, you've got to get federal grants. That's not a rumor. I know this directly. You've got to get federal grants. And the assistant professor says, you mean if I get $100K from Ford Foundation, that won't count? No brownie points for tenure? Nope. Why not? Because Ford won't hold still for 42%. That's the reason. I'm not being paranoid. That's really the way it works. So what does that mean? That means that people begin to feel they've got to research what the bureaucrat in Bethesda wants researched. And I have actually had students, including postdocs, sit in my office and say, well, what I'm really interested in is I'll have to wait and do that when I get farther along. What I'm going to do, I'm going to get a grant to study dental caries and Puerto Rican delinquents, because that'll sell at Bethesda. Anything you want to do on any minority group, or these days delinquents, or AIDS, will sell. And they'll get a correlation. I mean, there's a correlation between dental caries and IQ of about minus 25, and not due to poisoning but your brain, but due to social class as the common nuisance factor. But you'll get a big grant if you say it's all going to be about lesbians, or I don't know whether it would work to be about Irishmen anymore. Some minority group, or something that's hot in the news and politically active, that's where you can get money for. And there is also, to some degree, a certain amount of editing as to whether the projects might turn up something that people don't want turned up. I know, this is not a project of mine, I know the intimate details about a very good project on a certain dynamite topic that had the best design I've ever seen to study that particular subject. And it was not funded, and I read the pink sheet, and you never saw such crappy excuses for why it wasn't funded. If they used the same standards that they used to reject that project, they'd have to reject 90% of all the things that psychologists and other social scientists do. And I know perfectly well that wasn't funded because some people among the Bethesda bureaucrats were afraid of what the results might come out to be. So, this is not the psychology of discovery, but the sociology and economics and politics of discovery. How does that impinge the matter of evaluating theories in the context of discovery? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? You don't know, when you look at what has surfaced, to what extent the experiments in a given domain came to be performed because of the financial and other pressures upon academicians. You have no accurate way to assess that. You can't say whether it's big or little or middling. I don't know how big it is. I'm damn sure it's not zero. That the direction of research, because of the publish or perish pressure, which has become pathological, and I think bad for people's mental health and bad for science, It never was this bad when I was a young assistant professor. It really has become a malignant. And the economics of the situation, aside from the prestige and similar factors of people and the academy, those things will affect the distribution of investigations, so that if a meta-analysis or just an old-fashioned nose count, how many studies came out plus, how many came out minus, something as crude as that, is being relied on to assess the state of a theory, you have to have in the back of your mind, let's see, how did it happen that 100 studies were done using this procedure and only 10 using this one? Consider, for example, apparatus versus questionnaires. Suppose that due to methods covariance, which is everywhere we look, unless somebody does the extreme high-level conscientious kind of thing that Telligan does in his test, methods covariance everywhere we look, it's a lot cheaper to have to get it easier logistically to have 1,000 students take your one-page questionnaire to test FISB's theory of the mind than it is to use a tachistoscope on 1,000 students to test FISB's theory. Now, suppose it happens that the questionnaire method is one that is just in terms of its character sort of favorable, tend to give that theory a black eye. You don't have to be a dishonest person or a crook or an axe grinder. You're just going to pick up your end where you can get it, and you want to have a lot of power and use this and that statistical procedure, and so you gravitate to a questionnaire rather than to the lab. I'm not faulting anybody for doing that. But if it so happens in a particular domain that yes-no answers to questions in a questionnaire are favorable to a theory of a certain type, whereas doing an experimental manipulation on perception might lead you to some Popperian falsifiers, that theory gets brownie points, and it gets them because of what dollars are available, and the young assistant professor wanting to get articles and being told if you don't get federal grants, you're out. You'll have to go and teach at West Overshoe instead of the University of Minnesota. I think those are the three. Oh, what's the fourth one that's so damned obvious, but I'll mention it. When in the clinical domain or counseling, when you are relying upon clinical experience, because you don't have hard data or quantitative data, and you are not consulting your own because maybe you don't see a lot of patients of this particular type, so you're relying on the clinical experience of other people who have seen more patients of this kind, they are making moment-to-moment classifications in the interview, diagnostic or therapeutic, that, of course, are extremely much affected by the theory that they hold and where they got their training. And there's no correction for that. We don't know how to do anything about that. So you have the extreme case of if you have a Freudian and a an Adlerian having an argument, to the extent they ever talk anymore, but they're having an argument, and the one will say, well, if you would just shut up and listen, get the wax out of your ears, you would hear this stuff. And the other one says, well, no, I listen. I've had a lot of flying time trying to help people. I don't know where you get this penis envy stuff. That's not what I hear. And that one is deteriorates in a big hurry into my old man can beat your old man. He can not. He can too, and so on. Because here we are. I tell somebody, well, last time I counted, I figure I had about 10,000 hours of flying time as a psychotherapist. I haven't done it recently, but that was, say, 10 years ago. And so that ought to mean that I know a lot about the mind, isn't it? I mean, 10,000 hours plus listening to people. And then suppose you have different theoretical views from me, you'll have to just conclude that I don't listen very carefully, or that I poison my patients' minds by the nature of my interpretations. We know from the early work on the non-directive method that even the way you say, mm-hmm, and how much, has a shaping effect on the verbal behavior of the patient. So it's obvious that something like a psychoanalytic interpretation or Albert Ellis counter-propagandizing statement is going to shape up the patient to talk the way the therapist thinks patients should talk according to his theory. That one's so obvious, I assume I don't have to convince a room full of psychologists about it. That doesn't mean, of course, that the person who has such an axe to grind doesn't observe anything true. I didn't say that, did I? It just means that if they're fighting with each other, we don't have any way to decide who's right. When I used to teach the beginning clinical psych class, I relied on hard data when I had them, but in back in the 40s and 50s, there were a lot of things we didn't have hard data on that were of a clinical nature, and I relied on my clinical experience. And I would tell the class at the beginning, a lot of things I'm saying to you, I can't document. I didn't tally them at the time. They're in my head. And I think they're true. Probably about half of them are false. The problem is I don't know which half. So I'm going to tell you about all of them. And that's the only honest way to teach a clinical course. The students don't want you to stick to only hard data. They want you to talk about the patients that you've worked with and what your clinical wisdom and lore consists of, and that's perfectly okay. That's how medical school is taught, and that's how law school is taught, or used to be. But the problem with it is that you can take it as axiomatic that the most experienced, seasoned clinician trained to think scientifically, which we hope is if he comes out of this program, not some schools, but here, nevertheless, will come out saying something different from some other seasoned clinician. And that being so, we have to conclude that the clinical method may be truths, but it is not a satisfactory way of testing them. It is not a satisfactory way of testing them. If you get into an argument on a clinical matter with somebody who also has had clinical experience, and you say, this is what my experience shows, and the other person says, it ain't what mine shows, and you have been exposed to roughly the same kind of clientele. That's a full stop argument, isn't it? No place to go. No place to go. At that point, it is not rational to keep saying, well, I know I'm right because of my experience. Some people do that, but they shouldn't. That's an irrational proceeding. All right. Context of discovery and justification. On the other side, when do justification-like remarks appear in the other context, in the context of discovery? Very commonly. When we are trying to explain why it took so-and-so a long time to abandon his clearly false theory, we don't always appeal to the fact he had a father complex about his advisor, or the fact that he was a Trotskyist, or something like that. We also say, well, he did have this overarching principle that was widely held at that time by most scientists, and it appeared clear to him that if he allowed this particular thing, he'd be in terrible trouble with that principle. And that principle was believed on good evidence to be very sacrosanct. So that, for example, you're not going to find a physicist liking any explanation of an experiment that violates the conservation laws. Those kinds of considerations about what you could call a strain toward consistency within a rational mind obviously have to be mentioned in the context of discovery as well as the context of justification. Because otherwise, what would we be saying? We would be saying that there is a part of the psychology of the scientist that consists of things like his Oedipus complex or his social views or his being a Catholic or a Greek Orthodox or an atheist or the fried eggs he had for breakfast or he didn't like his advisor or whatever, or he was deferring to Bethesda. But as soon as we got to any of the causes of his behavior that are mediated by the fact he knows mathematics and logic, we would suddenly say we can't say anything intelligible about that. But that's goofy, isn't it? That's a very elementary mistake to make. That if we talk about psychic determinism, the only causes that were ever brought in are the bad ones, the hidden ones, the ones that Marx or Freud would look at, or Pareto, see? That's dumb. I mean, sometimes you come to conclusions because you know how to do a syllogism, and that's part of your background. You took logic, you learned about the undistributed middle, and you find yourself about to commit one, and so you don't. And that's part of the causation of your behavior. And it's absurd to say that the only causes that make a confluence into your scientific thinking are the irrational ones. In other words, that all reasoning is rationalization. Even Freud never said that, nor did Marx. They said things at times that make sound like they believe that. So, in the context of discovery, logic, mathematics, reasoning, principles of judgment play a role. When we are explaining the scientist's behavior, a major part of the explanation is that he learned to think scientifically, right? He had models, he read books, he took calculus and logic and so forth. He learned to think scientifically. And that's part of his, that's part of the stream of causality, just as much as the sunspots or the fried eggs or his castration anxiety or what else you might mention if you were thinking psychopathologically about him. So in that sense, we have a lot of spillage of justificationist talk into the context of discovery, because knowing how to think scientifically is just as much a part of the scientist as having prejudices of a religious or political or geographical or ethnic nature. Well, I guess I have to talk a little bit about truth. And then I promise you by next time and maybe by the end of today, we'll be talking about psychology specifically. Truth. I used to spend a whole hour browbeating the class on this, and I decided that the heck with that. Psychology students tend to have somewhat of a truth phobia because they were taught in beginning psych by somebody that we never get at the truth, or science doesn't claim to find the truth, or that scientific theories are merely fictions, and so on and so on. And there are some deep and interesting questions about scientific realism, and people who are not stupid or foolish can be found on all sides. I hope I don't make it sound as if you have to believe my doctrine, or otherwise you're dumb. My own view is that of the scientific realist, but that's only one view. It is the view that seems to me to be the most commonly held by scientists when they talk about their business rather than when they're talking epistemology. I mean, when they're actually talking about their science, they talk like scientific realists. By a scientific realist, approximately this will do for our purposes, I mean somebody who holds that there is an external world that is really out there, that it has certain objective properties, and that the business of science is to try to figure out what the heck those are. I think that's what most scientists act and think like when they're doing their thing, even though in a philosophy class they may talk differently. So that if somebody says, I don't care whether Freud's theory of libido is true or not, it's a very useful fiction, so I'm going to use it, I'm certainly not going to condemn him for doing that as a clinician. If he's in that position, is usually called instrumentalism. He says, I really don't care whether there is any such thing as the libido, but I find in working with my patients it helps me to talk as if there was such a thing, and that's a useful fiction, and I'm not going to beat him over the head and say, shame on you, go and stand in the corner, because he's an instrumentalist fictionist and I'm a scientific realist. I am myself not interested in scientific fictions, but if you are, that's fine. We won't send you to Siberia. My view on the libido as a, quote, good explanation of behavior, even if there is no libido, my friend Gardner Lindsay wrote a reply to McCorkadale and Neal in which he said almost that, not quite. Boy, did we needle him when he got to Minnesota about that one. He said, in effect, he said that I really don't care as a Freudian whether their libido really exists in the sense of McCorkadale and Neal's 1948 paper, because it's a useful fiction to explain neurosis. Now, if you say it's a useful fiction to me as a practitioner, I can't very well beat up on you there, and I won't try. I don't understand a person who says it's a useful fiction as an explanation. If a person tells me in the object language, this patient's libido is dammed up, and that's why her arm is paralyzed. And then he tells me in the meta language, but there isn't any such thing as libido. I really don't understand it. Now, if you do, that's fine. I don't understand a guy saying that. My view is that if there isn't any Santa Claus, then he ain't the one that brings the presents. And consequently, I'm interested in who the hell does bring the presents on. Now, there's no question that there are things that everybody knows that are fictions that fit a certain formal model. That's all right. But just so you'll know where I stand, I'm a scientific realist, and I am not interested in fictional explanations, but in the correct ones. And as I use the word fiction, I mean a novel. Now, the reason that scientists got into the habit of talking about fictions is that some scientists were very much afraid that they would be going out on a limb and going beyond what the hard, cold facts force us to hold. That was very true of scientists when they were trying to break free of philosophy, metaphysics, and theology. They wanted to be, what, tough-minded and close to the hard facts. And if you talk about unobservable entities and processes, you are obviously going beyond the hard facts. And so they felt that that was a little bit sinful to do that. And my only position is to say that, well, sometimes it's in the history of science been very, very fruitful to go beyond the hard facts and to introduce theoretical entities. And so I'm going to continue to do that as a psychologist, but I repeat, I'm not going to try to twist anybody's arm who chooses not to do so. Notable current, still living example, of course, the great B.F. Skinner. Now, you should not do Skinner an injustice in this matter. Some people who like to talk about fictions enjoy talking about theoretical constructs, like the Hullians or the Freudians or the cognitive psychologists, have implied that Skinner is such a dope that he doesn't know that electrons and molecules turned out to be very powerful in the other sciences. It's always unwise to attribute something that stupid to a man that smart. You know, when in doubt, you should figure that somebody that you've calibrated as having an IQ of 180, he could make a slip. Einstein forgot a minus sign in one of his derivations in the general theory of relativity. That's different. A careless slip like a clerical error. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a thought-through concept. It's never wise to attribute to a very smart person that he has a real dumb concept that he's thought about. And Skinner, I'm rereading his little book called Contingencies, a Reinforcement, good for my character. And I used to argue with Skinner when he was here about the Adams business, but he says that very plainly about page 3 of that little book. He says, and this is really good, this is really nice. He says, of course, certain kinds of theoretical entities have played a great and important role in the history of certain of the other sciences. No one would dispute that. But he takes note of the fact that where they have been profitable in the other sciences, it is frequently, I guess he says usually, that they were either A, at a great distance, or B, unusually small. That's nice. That's good. That's old Skinner grinding his axe in there, you know. At a great distance, like Betelgeuse or Alpha Centauri or something, or even some planet for Kepler. Very small, like a neutrino. But, as he always says in everything he writes, behavior, compared to these things, is relatively macroscopic and slow. Quote from Behavior of Organisms, page 1. Behavior as a subject matter is relatively macroscopic and slow. And if you look at the history of the other sciences, some of them got along in a very advanced stage, including a mathematical stage, with an extremely minimal use of hypothetical constructs. Compare, for example, what is called phenomenological thermodynamics with statistical thermodynamics. Phenomenological thermodynamics, talking in concepts of entropy and amount of heat and specific heat and stuff like that, and the heat engines had to make very little use of hypothetical constructs of the sort that statistical mechanics does when it talks about the molecules. Genetics is a nice example. The linkage map, population genetics, could do, what, 95% of its task without knowing anything about the cytology. Right? Linkage maps, Thomas Hunt Morgan and who were those characters? Bridges, Sturdivant, Miller, his assistants were working there with these flies and making these linkage maps. And as I recall the story, I may have it backwards, who had to convince whom, but my recollection is that Sturdivant or one of them had to convince T.H. Morgan to identify those positions on the linkage maps with physical loci on the chromosomes, which you could see under the microscope. He dragged his feet on that one initially. It became very clear when you've got translocations and stuff like that, and inversions, when the linkage maps acted just exactly like the damn chromosomes did. And then fortunately, divine providence, fortunately the animal that was mapped out more than anybody else had these giant chromosomes that they didn't know about initially in his salivary gland, where you could count down and say, here's position 32, there's that band, and you'd find a certain strain that had been irradiated by Miller with his x-rays, and it turned out that in that strain, something that was normally a recessive acted like a dominant, and the conclusion was, well, there must not be any allele at that other position. Position 13, you go and look at the giant chromosome, there's a hole there. The great stuff. At that point, would you say, what is theory and what is a hard fact? Well, you're looking at a hole, you're looking at a missing, a place where something's missing. Well, the point is that the cytology facilitated and led people to try a lot of things, but you could go a long way in descriptive or population genetics, including the fancy math. Decide about indexes of consanguinity as a reason for suspecting a recessive and all of that stuff without knowing the cytology of it. I don't dispute the cytology helped. I'm just saying that you could go an awful long way without knowing about that. And think how far we went before Crick and Watson. Just think how far genetics went before then. That's a big breakthrough, of course. So you got to do justice to Skinner. You mustn't treat him like an idiot. And when he says, well, the history of psychology has not shown that speculations about the innards have been terribly profitable, he can make a pretty strong case. Now, that's quite distinct from whether some of the other mentalistic constructs currently in favor are ones that are needed to do the job. There is where I collide with Skinner. I've been reading our distinguished chair Biederman's review article on the geons, the 36 basic things about which, out of which your brain makes all of its perceptions of fancier things. And after the fact, Biederman could go to Skinner and say, what do you make of all of this stuff? And Skinner wouldn't bat an eye. Of course, he would start talking about discriminated verbal operants and so on, and he could subsume the fact that you talk this way, and you wouldn't be able to make him embarrassed. But I am for damn sure that Skinner would not be able to come by designing those experiments at that level of talking about discriminated verbal operants. He wouldn't be able, in other words, to predict the findings in the verbal behavior beforehand. I know he wouldn't be. He doesn't try that kind of thing. He doesn't even try. The hell with it. It's programmatic. Whereas afterwards, he has no trouble subsuming it. So that's a complaint you can make to Skinner if he says, I have a general theory of behavior, which has always been his claim, even in 38, in the big book. In the last chapter, he says, this is the rat in the box pressing a lever, and people may ask what I want to extrapolate for the human. And he says, with the possible exception of language, of verbal behavior, I do not expect any new principles to be involved. And if you read the William James lecture, he also believes in the case of language that no new principles are involved. That's the way I would try to beat up on Skinner as a theoretician, but I would not try to beat him up on the grounds that he avoids hypothetical constructs like Hull's RG or Hebb's cell assemblies. His position there has always been coherent. Same position now he took when I knew him in 1939. Position was, and genetics is like this, position was, when the science of behavior becomes sufficiently advanced, and when the knowledge of the brain studied at its own level, not by inference, not the conceptual nervous system, as he snidely calls it, the CNS, studied at its own level by people who stick needles in neurons, that kind of thing. When that becomes sufficiently advanced, he says, it will be quite obvious what maps onto what. That was his position in 1938, and that's still his position at the present time. What exactly he would say, he's in very poor health, and I don't expect to see him before he dies unless I go to Harvard. He's not coming out here. But I wonder what he would say about the recent stuff that, with the single unit stimulation and so forth, as to whether, does that suggest to him that direct knowledge of the nervous system has become sufficiently far advanced that it's time to start the mapping, or would he say this is still premature? One of our candidates for the neurosciences slot there with her readings off the single cells firing in that particular place in the hippocampus, and there the rat is making up his mind in the maze, you know, and when he does it right, you can hear the little old thing. She had it in the videotape. The single cell firing was a click. I went home and told my my wife, who's a ex-rat psychologist, I was very excited about this, and she said, I'll bet you didn't think you'd live to see the day when you would hear a rat thinking. I thought that was pretty funny. That's exciting stuff. You're never going to get Skinner objecting to people doing that stuff, by the way. All he might say is, I still think we got to wait another 20 years before we worry about the mapping, before we worry about the isomorphism. Well, all right, you can take it for granted from here on that I'm a scientific realist and that I believe that things are out there rather than only in my head or society's collective head, and that science is supposed to try to find out how they really are. Three main theories of truth you hear about if you take a philosophy course, I'll merely mention them, I won't talk about them. The correspondence theory of truth, which is what a realist holds. The coherence theory of truth, which says that truth consists of the propositions you believe hanging together. And the instrumental theory, which I have just described, that's the fictionist one that says truth is what succeeds in predicting or controlling or manipulating successfully. People who hold the correspondence theory of truth, the realists, readily admit the other two as part of how you decide. I've never met a scientific realist or a holder of the correspondence theory of truth who denied that instrumental efficacy of theories at least bears on their truth. It isn't maybe a litmus test, but it bears on it. I think most of us, if we had doubts that mechanics was a decent science, were reassured that with the moonshot, right? If we can do that, there must be, the physicists must have something going for them. And they didn't even have to use Einstein, you know. They used Newtonian mechanics throughout because of the distances and velocities involved. So a correspondence theorist or a scientific realist is not one who dismisses coherence or instrumental power. Those are part of the data. A scientific theory which is incoherent cannot be true, literally, although, of course, it's quite possible for a theory to be coherent and be false. Let's go back to my Caesar example. Caesar crossed the Rubicon. There is one, in the realist way of thinking, or in the correspondence theory way of thinking, there is only one fact that's necessary and sufficient for the truth of that sentence, and that's the fact that he crossed. Okay? The way that logicians write that is, they got it. Quine corners after the logician Quine. You put quine corners about an expression when you want to deal with the expression as its own name.
We could name propositions by calling them Tom, Dick, and Harry, or we could call them Proposition 1, 2, 3, or the way Wittgenstein wrote the Tractatus, 1.03, 1.032, and so forth. Caesar crossed the Rubicon. The Quine Corners now tell us we are the subject matter of the sentence we're about to write. The subject of the sentence is the expression Caesar crossed the Rubicon. So we are in the meta language. If and only if, now with no quotes or Quine Corners, Caesar crossed the Rubicon. It's rather trivial, isn't it? That's all right. A lot of logic is trivial. This is way of looking at things comes from the Polish logician Alfred Tarski, who wrote a classic paper in 1936. And this way of talking about the truth concept is called the semantic conception of truth. Caesar crossed the Rubicon, a sentence. What am I doing? I'm sorry. Is true. Sorry. Caesar crossed the Rubicon, an expression, Quine Corners, names itself, is true if and only if, then we repeat it without any quotes around it. That's all. Now, to fix that up in detail, you need a formalized language. I'm not saying I'm giving you Tarski's semantic theory of truth, which is very technical and involved and requires a formalized language. But in a natural language, that's good enough for our purpose. So that stuff in the Vatican Library that we talked about the first meeting, those mounds of ink that the historian uses to decide whether he thinks that Caesar crossed the Rubicon, are evidentiary for him, just as being on horseback along with Caesar was evidentiary for the centurion. That's why we got rid of the positivist verifiability criterion, that we said we don't want this sentence to mean totally different things to the historian and to Caesar's officer. But if you ask not what grounds have we got for believing that he did, which is an epistemological question, you ask the ontological question, what are the conditions for that belief to be correct? The conditions for that belief to be correct is simply that the proposition, which is here in Quine Corners, describes the state of affairs in whatever language we're speaking, in this case, English. So there's a metalinguistic remark that says that this statement is true if and only if Caesar crossed the Rubicon. As I say, it's trivial. It's a tautology, but it's in the metalanguage. And looking at it that way is what is called the semantic conception of truth. Now, it's obvious that somebody could believe a true proposition and not have any good grounds for it. Right? I could get a bunch of people guessing the distance of the moon, and if I got enough of them, somebody would come close to 238,000 or whatever the heck it is. And he might not have any more grounds than the person who said 10,000, but he would be lucky. His sentence is true. The philosophers tend to define knowledge as justified true belief, so that they would not say this person had knowledge, because he wouldn't have any justification for it. Now, since in the semantic conception of truth, to say that a sentence is true is to say that it has this correspondence with the state of affairs that the sentence describes. We're in the metalanguage, and truth is a predicate of sentences and not of things. Truth is a predicate of sentences. There was a debate that took place among the positivists as to whether you should allow the word truth in the language. A very famous debate between Felix Kaufmann, I told you about him, I guess, the first day, one of the members of the Vienna Circle, and the logician Carnap. And Kaufmann argued that the positivists should quit using the word I guess he allowed the ones who did mathematics to use it, but they should quit using the word about empirical knowledge, because you could never be absolutely certain that what you said about anything empirical was true. And since Kaufman was pushing the old verifiability criterion, if he meant by verifiability not confirmation in the sense of probability, but verifiability, verification, if that's what you meant, then since you could never conclusively verify any empirical sentence, no matter how psychologically compelling it might seem, you shouldn't use the word true at all. There is a difference, of course, between psychological compellingness and corrigibility. I really can't doubt that I am now sitting in Elliott Hall giving a lecture in Minneapolis. But we know that it is theoretically possible that 10 seconds from now the surgeon should wake me up. Turns out that he's been stimulating certain portion of my brain and running off them. You know how those old philosophical things go. And I would say, well, that's the damnedest thing. I would have sworn I was there, and here I am on the operating table. That's all the bull sessions that we have when we take a philosophy course, and it's interesting to do. Carnap answered Kaufman in the following way, and if you want to read the details of this and really go through the logic of it, I used to spend, as I say, a whole hour on this thing, and it bored the class to death. But if you want to read the logic of it in detail, a rigorous treatment, read Carnap's reply to Kaufman in the Feigl and Brodbeck or Feigl and Sellers collection. I don't remember which it is. It's either the Readings in the Philosophy of Science or Readings in Philosophical Analysis. And there is a paper in there by Carnap on the concept of truth in which he is answering Kaufman. What Carnap said is the following. If you have a sentence like Caesar crossed the Rubicon, and you don't let me use the predicate true because I cannot be certain that that sentence is correct, you must be using some meta-linguistic rule which says that we may not include any words in our vocabulary when we're not absolutely certain that they can be properly applied. That's the overarching principle, he says. That's what Kaufman's premise is. It's clear that's what he's saying. Because we can never be absolutely certain that something is true, we shouldn't have the predicate truth in the language, in the meta-language. And Carnap says, well, that means that your guiding light here is that only those predicates which we can be certain of applying correctly in a given occasion are admissible into the language. And you're telling me that when I do metalinguistic discourse, and truth is inherently a metalinguistic predicate, it's not an object language predicate. So when Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, why, the philosopher would say, I don't understand how a person can be the truth, because truth is a predicate of sentences and not of people. Bertie Russell. Carnap says, now that's your rule. We will exclude any predicate from our language. We'll forbid people, ourselves and others, on the pain of speaking meaninglessness, violating the verification criterion of meaning. We'll forbid people to use a predicate in which there could be any conceivable doubt of its application in an instance. So Carnap hoists him by his own petard. He says, well then, you will obviously have to exclude this expression on the left from your language, because you just told me we couldn't be confident about that. All of the predicates of the descriptive language, both the scientific theory predicates as well as the predicates of the ordinary thing language, like warm and cold and green and so on, will have to be excluded. It might be that you will be permitted to use a few words referring to your immediate, ineffable sensory experience, assuming that to be absolutely certain. And that has been debated, as you know. It has been debated. There is evidence you could imagine evidence that would lead you to say, all that time I was saying green, 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 my brain was in a red state. I can't imagine what led me to keep tokening the sentence, this is green. So even the statements in the phenomenal language of sensory qualities are believed today by most people, both psychologists and philosophers, to be in principle corrigible. But even if you permitted them to be incorrigible, you said, I could be wrong about a lot of things, but that this looks green, damn it, that I couldn't be wrong about. I won't even say it is green, it looks green. All right, then you have a very impoverished language. I mean, you'll be able to walk around saying green, canoid patch. You won't be able to use any words like chair or schizophrene or the moon, let alone words like molecule. And Carnap's example wasn't Caesar. His example was this vessel contains alcohol, because that was Kaufman's example. And Carnap says, now, Kaufman, you're telling me I mustn't predicate true of the sentence because I can't be certain that this is alcohol. That's right. That's what Kaufman's saying. So I may not use this predicate because of your overarching principle. Only predicates that can be conclusively verified in their application are admissible. But you are basing that on your doubt as to whether this vessel contains alcohol, right? You are pointing out that I can't be certain this contains alcohol. So I now apply your big rule and strike the word alcohol from the language. Add also the word vessel. Maybe we'll leave the word this. I don't know about that. Well, Carnap wrote that, and Kaufman never replied, but of course he couldn't. I mean, there is no reply to that. If you have a meta-language requirement that you may not employ any predicates about which you could conceivably have any doubt in a particular case as to whether they're applicable, then it's true that the word true will go out of your meta-language, and all of the empirical words, certainly all the scientific theory words, will go out of your object language. So you won't be able to say, you'll be able to make sort of like a pithed frog, you know. As Feigl once pointed out, even when I say this is green, there's a background notion that I am employing the quality word green in the way I have in the past and plan to in the future, and B, the way other English speakers use the word, see Wittgenstein and company. So even that one is a little fragile. Point, don't be nervous about the concept of truth on the grounds that you can only have probability that you've got it. You can only have probability of the sentence in the object language, and therefore you can only have probability that the sentence in the object language is true. One of the ways of seeing that is that Caesar crossed the Rubicon if and only if Caesar crossed it. These are equivalent in their content. But this whole statement that this sentence is true is in the meta language. Taking this part, that's in the object language. But they are equivalent in what they assert, right? I mean, there's a one-to-one relationship between them. If it's false that Caesar crossed the Rubicon, then it's false that it's true that Caesar crossed the Rubicon. In other words, if this sentence is false, then the attribution truth here in the Quine Corners is incorrect. Whereas if he in fact crossed, then the attribution is okay. So that there is no difference in the content, so to speak, the descriptive content of the statement, Caesar crossed the Rubicon, and the statement, it is true that Caesar crossed the Rubicon. No difference in content. One, if one is the case, the other is the case. The difference is that one is metalinguistic and the other is object linguistic. So you don't have to be phobic about truth. I think the reason that psychologists, other than being operationists as freshmen, have a fear of it is that it sounds kind of dogmatic and authoritarian. Well, it's no more dogmatic to say it's true that Caesar crossed than it is to say Caesar crossed, since they both assert the same thing and they're both supported by the same data. And if you don't feel sinful saying Caesar crossed, there's no reason you should feel sinful saying, I believe it to be true that he crossed. Same content. One is metalinguistic, the other is object linguistic. And just as you would say metalinguistically, of course, I could be wrong that Caesar crossed, in the same way, I could be wrong in thinking it was true that Caesar crossed. Again, no difference. Both corrigible. That he crossed is corrigible by certain kinds of evidence. That it's true that he crossed is corrigible by exactly the same evidence. There's no difference in the evidence that bears on those two. Well, in 3 minutes, verisimilitude is truth, likeness, or degree of truth. And it is also an ontological rather than an epistemological concept. Just as only omniscient Jones knows whether a sentence is true, only omniscient Jones knows how much verisimilitude it has. But we attempt to estimate it. Now, nobody has succeeded in giving a satisfactory logician's explanation of it, which is most unfortunate. However, nobody has given a completely satisfactory explication of the word probable or of the word random, and we all use that. And there are a whole bunch of deep words that we use as psychologists that we can't avoid, even though they're not entirely cleaned up yet by the logician. We'll talk about the probability one. Boy, is that a mess. So we are going to use the word verisimilitude with a clear conscience, recognizing that someday some logician has to fix it up rigorously. It means how close to the truth a statement is. And you might say, well, statements are either true or false. They're not true or false in degree. Well, a simple single statement about a simple entity is either true or false, whatever a simple entity is. See Wittgenstein, the Tractatus. But there aren't any scientific statements that are like that, are there? Even single propositions in science are about complex entities. All crows are black when you look at it closely. Scientific theories are collections of statements, and they're not just a heap either. They're interconnected collections of statements. And because there consists of more than one statement about a simple, scientific theories can have degrees of truth. And the easiest way to think of that is a newspaper story varying from one that was accurate in every detail to one that was accurate except it got my middle initial wrong to one that got my middle initial wrong and spelled my name Neely and had me driving a Saab rather than a Volvo in this accident to one that got that wrong and got the wrong intersection to a story totally made up, say like Goebbels' story of the Polish soldiers and the radio station, I forget the name of the station. When they wanted to whomp up the war against the Poles, the Gliwice radio station, they had some criminals that they killed stuffed into Polish uniforms. So that story was made up out of whole cloth. It had no verisimilitude. Now, we have to have that concept, right? We can't get by without a concept that some things are truer than others, even though they're literally false in at least one respect. And some scientific theories are in better shape than others. Phlogiston has no truth to it. The kinetic theory has quite a bit of truth. Maybe Einstein's theory has the whole truth, who knows? Degrees of truth, or truth-likeness, we can't dispense with. Scientists who never heard of Popper recognize that. What are they doing when they're patching up a theory, amending it, fiddling with it? They're trying to increase its verisimilitude. Well, I'll say more about that next time, but the basic idea is, even though the logicians haven't been able to figure out a satisfactory definition of the concept, they've tried. Popper tried several times, gave up. It's a concept that we can't avoid having, and so I'm going to use it with a clear conscience. Okay. Don't forget, if you haven't got a reading list or my two nights paper, they're here.